abelian group where you don't know the structure a priori, and we really have to use this algorithm, is say taking elliptic curve E, consider it over f of t. You know, there's a theorem which tells you that this group is either cyclic or a product of two cyclic groups. But what is the structure? What are explicit generators? How, if you had a matrix, a linear, if you had sort of some function x on this, such as the Frobenius endomorphism, say acting on the points over fp squared, if you wanted to explicitly write down that matrix, you would need to be able to compute in this group. You need to be able to write a generic element in terms of generators for the group. All of these things can be done just using the ideas I'm going to explain in a second in this simple case. You just have to pseudo and generalize them. And it's not too hard, but it can be pretty tedious. Another good example that's really popular of a group that people work with is you take the Jacobian of a curve over a finite field and then consider its points. Another example of a group of points where you get an abelian group, but the exact structure is pretty mysterious. Each point is represented using some like really tricky, subtle divisor construction due to Cantor. And amazingly, using the baby step giant step algorithm, you can work out the structure and you can write down explicitly a couple of points, and you also can get data out of baby step giant step that will allow you to write any point as a linear combination of those generating points. So baby step giant step is really at the heart of linear algebra in the context of abelian groups, where you have an abelian group by some abstract theorem, say coming from arithmetic of algebraic curves or abelian varieties, but you don't have explicitly the elements. Another more down-to-earth, possibly, situation is class groups of number fields. With a class group, you have ideal classes, but you're not just given the group structure as Z mod, whatever Z, and these are the generators. If you have an ideal class, and you know it happens to generate, you have another ideal class, how do you write, or say you have three ideal classes and they generate your class group, and you have a fourth ideal class, which is just given by some generators, how do you write it in terms of the three generators that we have already? Again, the baby step, giant step algorithm gives a way to do that. So let me just explain this to you in a way that you'll completely understand and remember this special case. But you should know that this is one of the most basic algorithms in all of computational number theory / group theory. Okay, so here it is. Let's fix the generator G of this group. So in fact, I'll write it as group generated by G. And let's let A be in here. The problem is to write find n such that g to the n equals a. And here's how you do it. One, let m equal the ceiling of square root of p. And then write down make a list in your computer of the following elements of your group. And you should notice that everything I'm doing is completely generic. I'm not using Z mod PZ at all. So you make a list of the elements of your group. G to the M, G to the M, or G to the 2M, all the way up through G to the M minus 1 times M, and then G to the M squared. These are called the giant steps, because you're taking your generator and then you're taking giant steps. You're going a long ways away from, say, g squared or g cubed. You're taking a whole bunch of giant steps. That's what I call giant steps. So that's the first thing you do. The second thing you do, well, not the second step, but also make a list of the small steps. So you take a and you multiply it by g, multiply it by g squared, all the way up through multiplying it by g to the m. These are called the baby steps. Now, here's the amazing thing. There has to be something in the top list that's also in the bottom list. And once you can figure out what that match is, you can read off n. Okay? So two, possibly by sorting the list or some other magic, but one way would be to just sort the lists. If each of the lists are sorted, By sorted, I just mean there are elements of Z mod PZ star, so just sort this list of integers between 0 and p minus 1. Then you can define two that are identical. You just march along until you see that there's a match. And you will eventually find them. I'll explain why in a minute. But sort the lists and find a match. And by match, I mean something in the top list is equal to something in the bottom list. And here, I is, of course, in the range that you iterated over in the top, between 1, it's kind of funny, actually. Okay, I think this might be wrong. Maybe this should be cheated as 0 times n. It doesn't make sense to have 1, 2, 3, and then here suddenly you have g. It just doesn't seem right. But when I explain to you why this works and what's going on, you'll see that this probably has to be 0m, and we'll figure out what the right answer is. Okay, and this will make figuring this out will help you to be more actively engaged. So you find a match. Now from the match you can read off. The reason is because just divide both sides by g to the j, and you get g to the im minus j is equal to a. And that's incredible, because that tells you that I times m minus j, that's your n. Okay, and that's the baby step transitive algorithm, the simplest of incarnation. You simply make two lists of numbers, you find a match in the lists, and then once you have the match, you can read off the exponent. And that solves the discrete log problem in time and space O of square root of p. And what I mean by in time is that the number of operations required to carry out this whole procedure is some constant multiple of square root of p, and the number of, or the amount of memory that you need, which is a serious problem if p is large, is also square root of p. Because after all, in order to find this match, you really have to store at least everything in the first list. You don't have to store everything in the second, because you can just look as you go. Yes, please.
Can you sort that fast?
Let's see. You can sort a list of length n in time. N, is it n log n or just log n?
N log
n. N log n.
But you can probably sort it as you're writing.
Yeah, so you don't actually, perhaps this whole sorting thing is stupid, because as you write down each of these, you just simply check to see if it's in the first list. But I guess you need to sort to be able to check quickly.
Well, you're sorting the list with length squared of n, so it's squared of n log n squared.
Oh, right. Thank you. Yes. So the sorting that you have to do is square root of p log square root of p. But that does draw up when you touch the analysis because of the log.
It should be faster than going through the whole square root of p list and looking for something, but I don't know.
Yeah. I think, once you've done that, it's at each stage it's square root of p log root. I mean, it's at each stage you have to do. It looks like it might be to go of root p log root p, at least the way I'm presenting it. Unless there's some trick. So it probably is.
Well, it's root p modular exponentiations.
Well, the modular exponentiations, but too hard. I think, let's see, you could probably do something like using a hash function, you could compute a hash of each of these, and then each time you compute one of these, you check that whether its hash agrees with the hash of one of these, and
the intersection. Like you have both lists at the same time.
Yeah. I'm just worried. I mean, definitely do it of root p log root p, but I'm a little worried about the. You can start very quickly, but you still have to look at every element. So. And do something, so you end up with root p log p. You know, log root p is compared to root p. So, and in fact, in a lot of complexity analysis, people still don't bother with the log factor. Softly, they just use the word softly or something. They just ignore the log factors. But for complete distance, be careful, right? And since that's all I'm explaining to you, so you can do it in O of root p log root p. But sorting a list of length n using quicksort is O of n log n. And n is square root of p, so it's O of root p log p, log root p. So you do that for both of them. That's still, since you only did it twice, that's still big O of square root of p log root p. And now marching along is square root of, you have to do square root of p of these. And each time you have to do a search to see if you've seen, actually, no, you don't have to do anything because you've already sorted them. So it's just O of square root of p to find a match. And modular exponentiation, this is just, I'm not actually, so you have to do one of these, but then, which is, just involves writing n in binary. But after that, you just keep multiplying by g to the n. That's just one multiplication and reduction. So that's just a constant number of arithmetic operations. And likewise down here. So you have O square root of p plus some constant that's a lot smaller number of arithmetic operations. So it actually looks like at least the algorithm I'm showing is O square root of p log root p. So there's an extra log factor. And the space is square root of p. But that's a heck of a lot better than just doing something that loops through everything. That would be just O of p. Okay, so what I need to tell you is why this works. I mean, why in the heck should there actually be a match at all? Actually, does anybody see why there has to be a match?
Division algorithm.
Yeah, exactly, the division algorithm. Because this is a cyclic group and G is, by assumption, a generator, we have this n. You can write n using the division algorithm as I times n. Minus j, where I and j are between 0 and m. Well, certainly you can do that, because you just divide by m and take the remainder. Although, actually, that's a little funny with the j being negative, so really I mean that I and minus j are between, which is all I'm really using. So the fact that you get a match, the proof that this works is just the division algorithm. That's all there is to it. Every integer you can write it this way, the fact that you can write it this way means that if you multiply across, you have a collision like this, and allows you to find the n. And yes?
So my I is varying from 0 to n minus 1.
Yeah.
Minus j.
Well, actually, the I is going from 0 to n. Here, because I'm including this. And then the j is going from 1 through m. So is that a problem?
You can make your j go from 0 to minus 1.
I think I want to make the j go from 0 to m minus 1.
So that means I should include a.
And, yeah, so and I do want to split this. Yeah, okay, is that better? Okay, and I definitely want g to the 0 n, because that would correspond to 0 times n, which could happen.
Right, but why do you need n remainders?
Yeah, so let's see, we can tighten it up a little. I don't need this one at the end. This was unnecessary. And
you don't need your last
one. I don't need this one either. Right, so I don't need either of the last two. I mean, I could have both of the last two and not the first two, just one or the other. But it's more natural, given we're using the division algorithm, to omit the last two. Okay? Alright, so I'll change this to write to n minus 1. Okay, so is everybody happy? If you now know the baby step giant step algorithm, you really feel like you know this. Good. I'm trying to think, what remarks can I make about generalizing this to finding actual structure and so on? Well, I better not say anything about that, but suffice to say that there is a way to take the information you get out by recording these lists and finding specific elements that generate and recording some things involving exponents. You can get the data you need to do explicit calculations in any finite abelian group. And if you look, say, at Magma's source code, you'll find that in the case of a generic abelian group, it has an implementation of this sort of thing that keeps track of the data that you get out of here. It works good in a general group life. Still, it's horrible if P were the sort of P that they use in the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So if you look at, if you've ever used SSH, which everyone here hopefully has, right at the beginning of the session, it agrees on a key that it uses to set up some way to exchange additional information. And it actually uses the Diffie-Hellman key exchange here. And the P that it uses is presumably quite large, like 512 bits or 1024 bits or whatever. And when it's that big, this algorithm isn't useful at all. Okay, so that finishes baby step, giant step. Unless there's anything else to say.
So did you say that it's been proven that we're not going to get an algorithm more efficient than this?
In a completely generic group, it's a theorem that you won't. But if any actual group in real life has some additional structure, and like an elliptic curve group or Z mod PZ star, and for these, we don't know. It might very well be that there's a fast way of computing discrete logs here. And there is a faster way than this, called the number field zip, which does do it more quickly than this. There's a crossover. I mean, for small p, this is the best. But for large p, where the difference between large and small depends on actual people implementing things. But for large p, number field zip is better than this, significantly better. It's sub-exponential, whereas this is exponential in number of digits. This takes if as a function of the number of digits of p, square root of p is exponential. This is, let's just count this, but this is exponential in number of digits, but there are sub-exponential algorithms. So in a completely generic group, which I'm not prepared to define for you, there is no better algorithm. But a major open problem is actually to give something better for, say, elliptic curves. We'll talk about that a lot. I had a student do an undergrad senior thesis a couple of years ago, and his thesis was on how basically, so you can do discrete logs quickly here, or more quickly than you can do them. Much to say. It's just this, there's this weird gaping hole in the theory that for elliptic curves there doesn't seem to be a good discrete log algorithm, anything better than just this. It doesn't seem to be anything. And it's sort of weird because with quantum computers you can do discrete logs really quickly. And, I don't want to say more about that, but it's certainly a very interesting area of research. And a lot of people are interested in it. Okay, so another, just to give you a quick tour of the rest of the notes, since we only have a few minutes. Section 442 just describes how you can enumerate all the values of a Dirichlet character. If your character is modulo something like, say, 2006, and you're going to evaluate it billions of times, because you're doing some modular symbols calculation or something, and the Dirichlet character, as you'll see, comes up, for example, in computing queue expansions, when computing modular symbol spaces, and so on, you just might as well make a list of all values of your character. And you don't want to solve the discrete log problem for every element of Z-mod 2060. That would be completely idiotic. So instead, you just do the stupid thing like your odometer and your cardinals, where you just iterate through all the elements. It might be something slightly better, but I can't imagine what it would be. Section 443 is just very straightforward. It just tells you how to go from a quadratic symbol, the Kronecker symbol, to a Dirichlet character represented in the way I represented them in here. But it's really very trivial. The interesting thing, though, is that there's a good algorithm for evaluating Dirichlet character mod, say n, that's quadratic, and it's much better than involved. You don't have to factor, you don't have to do discrete logs or anything. And it's described in detail in Cohen's book, section 114. So if you ever end up having to compute Dirichlet characters in a quadratic, this could be better. And that's actually another thing for Michael. If you wanted to do something with the Dursley characters package in Sage, it doesn't. I don't think it has anything where it takes a quadratic character, and if you ask to evaluate it, it turns it into a Dirichlet character and uses the fact that you can do it more efficiently. But that could be something to add. Conductors, I already told you about that. I'm not going to go into any detail about the algorithm that's listed here, except to say that it involves... Well, the proof is strangely long, but that's just how it is. Let's see. And there's a bunch about restricting and extending Dirichlet characters. So if you have a Dirichlet character mod, one thing, you can extend it. If you have a Dirichlet character mod n and has conductor f, and you have any integer that is divisible by f and divides n, then you can get a corresponding Dirichlet character mod that integer. Actually, if you have any integer, if you have a Dirichlet character mod n, and f is its conductor, then for any integer that's a multiple of f, there's a there's a Dirichlet character that comes from your original Dirichlet character. So there's a way to compute that, which is pretty obvious if you think about it, especially obvious given the representation of Dirichlet characters. And the last section is about alternative representations. And I don't really want to go into too much detail. This is the sort of thing you might want to read. And I probably won't, I don't think I'll say too much about. Just to tell you that there's a lot of different choices for how you can represent these. And every other one is really hard to deal with. I'm trying to understand it very well as I look at this. So the way we represented a Dirichlet character is we gave a list of the values of the Dirichlet character on generators for our abelian group. In Paris, if you look at the bottom of page 77, I've quoted from the manual of Paris, the way they represent a Dirichlet character is more complicated. Instead of giving the actual values that the character takes on, they give a list of integers, and the integers are numbers that you have to raise some other tricky numbers too, in order to get the values of the Dirichlet character. So instead of recording something like I and minus 1 here and the actual values, in Paris what they would do is, for each factor, you would have to give a number that you raise the appropriate power of some root of unity to in order to get I. And they stored those instead. But so Dirichlet characters, instead of being lists of powers of roots of unity, they're just lists of integers, and from the list of integers you can recover this. But it's very confusing just looking at the list of integers to understand anything about the Dirichlet character. And to give algorithms directly in terms of the list of integers is extremely painful and error-prone. Because, for example, if you want to take a Dirichlet character and extend it to a different modulus, the meaning of the integers for the other modulus is totally different. So you have to just figure out what the right integers are for the other one. And you end up with all kinds of bugs that are really hard to fix. Okay, so that's it. We're done with chapter 4. And on Wednesday, we'll start with chapter 5, which is about Eisenstein series. Again, but these are Eisenstein series attached to pairs of Dirichlet characters. And if you want to read about it, you can look in the book, of course. There's a book by Yaki on modular forms, which has lots and lots of discussion about Eisenstein series. Tons of analysis. I guess that's what we'll start on next time. And I'll end up talking about Bernoulli numbers attached to Dirichlet characters a whole bunch as well.